Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, May 16, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as today we discuss the future of Guantanamo Bay. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We'll hear first from Stephen A. Engel. He's a partner at Deckert right here in Washington, D.C., followed by Karen Greenberg. She's director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham Law School. They're going to have a little back and forth between them, but as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of your questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Mr. Engel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and good afternoon here. As someone who dealt with Guantanamo issues in the last several years of the Bush administration, I find it quite remarkable that here we are now almost through the end of the president of the Obama administration, and Guantanamo remains with us. And not only does it remain with us, but I would submit that the issues surrounding the Guantanamo Bay facility have hardly changed, over the course of these 7 years. There's been ups and downs and bumps in the road, but the goals that President Obama set at the very start of his administration, I think he has consistent, they still remain, but by the same token, the Guantanamo population, while slightly smaller, more than slightly smaller, depending on your point of view, still remains in roughly the same place. And maybe by virtue of background on the topic, let me just run through a few dates and numbers about where we are. On January 22nd, 2009, which I believe was the second day that President Obama was in the Oval Office, he signed an order that provided for the closing of the Guantanamo Bay facility, and the president set a one-year deadline pursuant to which the facility would close. Within the scope of that year, he directed his administration to try to figure out what to do with the people who were there at Guantanamo Bay. And at the time, there were about 242 detainees in January of 2009. President Obama's administration convened an interagency task force to review the dossiers of the individuals there. And I think maybe to the surprise of some of them, a number of the folks came to the conclusion that a fairly significant portion of the population are the kind of folks who the United States would need to detain for the foreseeable future. I think that there was also a very large, a significant number of people who the United States was prepared to release if they could find foreign countries that are able to take them. And then a third subset, and really the smallest amount of that population, were individuals who the administration had evidence, or the United States has evidence, that they've committed specific war crimes, and those individuals could be subject to prosecution in either the military commission system, which the Obama administration has largely stuck with, or in federal civilian courts. The result of this analysis, I think, is that the Obama administration decided fairly early that it would need a framework for the long-term detention of individuals who are subject to the law of war. And we now have what I think is a bipartisan consensus, although it's certainly not universal, that supported by both Congress, the President, and the Supreme Court, that the United States has the legal authority to detain individuals under the law of war for the duration of hostilities. And what becomes gray and harder for us is that while we're still fighting in Afghanistan and we're back in Iraq and other theaters throughout the world, it's difficult to understand when a global conflict against al-Qaeda or its affiliates or however defined will end. And so the law of war framework could be for a very long time indeed. With that being the case, on the big picture question, The question that the Obama administration has had to solve is, okay, if you don't like Guantanamo Bay, and if you don't like that facility, and if you believe it hurts our reputation abroad, what are you going to do about it? Where are the individuals going to be housed? And obviously the only alternative, or the likely alternative there, would be someplace in the United States. The notion of moving the Guantanamo population to the United States for long-term detention has proved difficult and maybe even insuperable for this administration. And I think the reasons for that, which I think we'll discuss on this call, come from both sides of the debate, because well, there may be a bipartisan consensus around a framework for law of war detention. There's a lot of division within the president's own party over that proposition. Many of whom folks on the Democratic side believe that people should either be prosecuted or released. And then by the same token, on the Republican side of things, well, there was a moment in which there appeared to be a bipartisan consensus on moving Guantanamo into the United States for reasons involving Guantanamo and not involving Guantanamo. That consensus has broken down, and the president has been unable to persuade the Republican Congress to fund or set up a framework for Guantanamo in the United States. That whether or not folks recognize that Guantanamo causes us some harm abroad, at least at present, it has been the least worst outcome of a real, serious problem and issue for the United States, which is detaining these people who are enemies of our country and are potentially dangerous to release. With this in place, the Obama administration has continued to work on reducing the Guantanamo population and releasing those people who they can release, which is easier in principle than in practice, because even if there are people who the United States thinks would be a tolerable risk to release, you still need to put them somewhere. And in many cases, their home countries can't take them or won't take them for a variety of reasons, including that we're concerned that these people will be treated inhumanely there. We're concerned that these people would return to the fight, as they say, if they're transported back there, and in some cases that their home countries just simply don't want them. And so there has been a considerable amount of energy spent within the State Department and the Defense Department to try to, and other agencies, to negotiate individual releases over the course of the past 7 years. And so while President Obama's administration inherited 242 detainees, as of April, there were about 80 left. Of those, 27 are eligible for transfer if the United States can find places to take them. About, depending on how you count, a dozen or so are potentially subject to prosecution in the military commission system, and that really leaves about 40 others whom the Obama administration has determined should be kept in U.S. custody for the long term. Of late, as we near the end of the Obama administration, President Obama has continued to assert, and his administration has continued to assert, that they intend and hope to close Guantanamo before the end of his administration. Time is running out, but there have been trial balloons and discussions over whether and how the president might do that. One of the most provocative is an argument that two of the president's former advisors, the former White House counsel Greg Craig, who was involved in the initial executive order to close Guantanamo, and Clifford Sloan, who had worked on detainee issues as the president's special envoy when he was in the administration, provocatively opined that the president could close Guantanamo even if Congress opposed the closing. And for the last half a dozen or so years, the federal law has prohibited the administration from using funds to transfer Guantanamo individuals into the United States. Congress, by doing so, has both announced its policy and its opposition to closing Guantanamo, and two, has also assured that it gets a seat at the table. And Mr. Craig and Mr. Sloan opined that, in their view, those restrictions were unconstitutional, that the president, as the commander-in-chief, had authority that was so broad that Congress could not restrict him from moving military detainees to the United States. Now, I think that conclusion is debatable, and I'm reason to doubt the Department of Justice would ultimately agree with that take, or that much less the Department of Defense would accept it. But that idea has been thrown on the table. Meanwhile, in about 2 months ago, either February or March of this year, the Department of Defense presented its plan to close Guantanamo Bay during the administration. This plan was more or less a rerun of where the policy has been, focusing as much upon transferring the individuals who are eligible for release than it is actually on dealing with the ultimate question of long-term detention. And so I think there are real questions about whether that plan provides a framework forward. So one question for us to discuss, I think, is whether or not the president will be successful in his effort to close Guantanamo Bay before his time runs out. And then the second question is, if not, what comes next for the next administration? So maybe this is a good point at which to hand off the discussion to Karen, for her take on some of these issues.
Right. Well, that was actually an excellent sort of overview, touching on a lot of points that I think we can talk about. I want to just start by saying that I share Steve's sort of astonishment at the duration of Guantanamo and how few of the issues really have changed. The only thing I want to add to that, and this was sort of embedded in your comments, is that it's gotten harder, not easier, to close Guantanamo. And the main reason has been the passage of the part of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which forbids the transfer of Guantanamo detainees to the United States. So whatever plans the Obama administration had to start with, this obstacle wasn't one that they were thinking about when they predicted that it would close within a year. And once they had not done things quickly with Guantanamo, which is what I actually think happened, the idea of announcing, it's always easy to look at this in hindsight, but what they should have done is closed it rather than submit it to this lengthy process that had to be vetted by a lot of different political agendas. And so now, and we have been stuck throughout the Obama administration with just one intractable problem after another. So one thing is this inability this ban on transferring detainees to the United States, which would in some way move the problem. It wouldn't exactly close Guantanamo, because Guantanamo is about indefinite detention. And as long as we have this category of indefinite detention, then in essence, I guess philosophically, it isn't closed. But let's take it on Obama's terms. What he wanted to do was close the facility, and we can talk about these other things as we go forward today. But the second piece I just wanted to bring up to add to what Steve has laid out for us is the military commissions. In addition to indefinite detention, which is what you're talking about for most of the detainees, we have the issue of the military commissions. Military commissions, which began in 2008, were interrupted at the beginning of the Obama administration when President Obama said, as he launched these various task forces on Guantanamo and on detention policy, he suspended the military commissions, which then, as you know, came back into being and revived. And really, when you think about this, have gone nowhere. How many pretrial hearings can you have with one problem after another, some of it procedural, some of it interagency fighting, some of it problems with evidence, and the problems just go on and on. And so I think you cannot talk about closing Guantanamo until you address forthright the issue of what happens with the military commissions, because there is a scenario. If you look at the pace at which the periodic review boards are going, and periodic review boards are where that category of the 40 or so that Steve laid out, where they haven't been charged, they haven't been released, and so are they there indefinitely, or is a reassessment of their case make the panel think that they should be released. So there's, and some of them may be charged eventually, but there's 40 or so. And as that category is whittled down, Guantanamo, by the time Obama leaves the presidency, could be a very small number of individuals that have not been cleared for release. If that happened, the idea of transferring these individuals to American shores may change in terms of the determination of Congress, because right now, the detainee population per detainee, estimates are that it's costing about $5.5 million per detainee per year to maintain the base. That's an awful lot of money. And as each detainee is released, that number per remaining detainee goes up. So it's conceivable that there will be a calculation made when you have 20 or so detainees at Guantanamo Bay, that the idea of bringing them and dispersing them to different facilities, perhaps in the United States, or putting them in one place, whatever it is, that it may seem viable to either to bring them here. So that's one thing. And that will leave the military commissions. The estimates on starting the 9/11 trial, the most recent estimates of lawyers involved in the process, is that the 9/11 trial may not start until 2020 and will take several years once it started. So I do think that one important piece of deciding whether and how to close Guantanamo is, in a somewhat ironic way, that we have to deal not with indefinite detention so much as what happens to the military commissions. So I just wanted to put that out there. And then I want to return a little bit to this notion of the executive powers. Does the president have the right to just say Guantanamo closed, transfer the detainees, whether they're up for military commission or not, in defiance of Congress to the United States? I think that is probably the last step this president would want to take. I think he wants to close Guantanamo. I think exerting that kind of executive power after all the criticisms this administration made of executive power during the prior administration is probably not the chosen road they want to go down. But having said that, I think they want to close this place, and I think this president is going to close it. What you see if you look at the numbers who have been released for transfer and transferred over the past 6 months is a steady stream of individuals leaving Guantanamo and a steady stream of individuals being cleared, not all of them, but most of them being cleared for release when they come up with the periodic review board. So it's going to be one of these. If you look at the numbers, which is essentially 30 over the past 6 months, and you have 44 left, I mean, if you look at the numbers, if they speed up the process as they've started to do, if they appoint yet another judge to sit on some of these cases, if they move this with a greater speed, it's possible we're going to get very, very close to the scenario I've laid out, which is a handful of people at Guantanamo before the end of this presidency. So I don't know if that helps, Steve, to sort of give you a sense of where I'm at, but. Does any of that surprise you?
Sure. Let me take that in a few different ways. I guess with respect to whether the periodic review boards could solve the problem in a sense. I mean, I think we're in a situation here where, and the periodic review boards are a version of a kind of review. We call it maybe a parole-like administrative function in which individuals' dossiers are evaluated, and it ensures that the United States is continuing to make an accurate finding as to whether these individuals pose a long-term security threat to the United States. Are these people who would, again, potentially return to the fight? Are these enemies of our country that we would, that we think have to be kept locked up so long as this struggle, war is continuing to go on? I am skeptical that that simply the parole boards, so to speak, or these PRBs could solve the problem much. I mean, just by way of example, the president's detainee task force report in 2010 identified the population is containing 48 detainees who are too dangerous to transfer, but not feasible for prosecution. The numbers I've seen say that there's 40, you know, currently in that box. The difference between 48 and 40, is 8 of those. I would imagine that several of them are the ones who were bartered in the deal for the American soldier who deserted and was captured by the Taliban. And you know, that being the case, I don't think we've seen a lot of movement within that say the hardcore jihadi population, over the last, that's a period of 6 years essentially. So I think you're right. From a cost perspective, as Guantanamo shrinks, the cost per detainee goes up. That's always struck me. It's interesting to me the way in which the administration has continued to focus on that, which I think to some degree suggests that they're losing the public argument when it comes to closing Guantanamo for other reasons. In every statement that the administration makes on this, there is a description of the need to close Guantanamo as a national security imperative, and there is almost boilerplate language at this point as to the harm that Guantanamo Bay, allegedly causes the United States on the diplomatic front. And, I have no doubt that folks do experience some blowback, and there is concern among our allies for Guantanamo, just given where it was in the early years of the administration. But it seems that has been, as time moves forward, that goes into the past, it seems to me, and increasingly there's a focus on the cost, which again I think is because it's been the administration has not succeeded in persuading Congress that there's a safer and better solution there. But that being the case, I guess I'm skeptical. If we're at about 80 people now, and while 60 would be a smaller number than 80, I'm not sure that that's really a game changer here. I would suggest, and then with respect to the legal authority, I would be quite shocked if this president were to take the view that Congress had no role to play when it comes to housing long-term belligerents. In a war, there's a strong argument that Congress has an express constitutional authority to regulate captures in the war and in wartime. And although there's debate about whether that includes people or just boats, it seems that between the Congress's power of the purse, its authority to regulate the military, and the express authority over captures, it's a pretty strong argument that Congress has a role to play. And for the administration to ignore that, I think would both be erroneous and would be as expansive as any of the suggestions I think that were seen in the prior administration with respect to the commander in chief power. So it would be a remarkable turnaround if the inability to win things in Congress led the president to assert that version of the executive authority. And then the only other practical point on this is that the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the U.S. military would be the ones required to actually do the closing of Guantanamo on the ground, and the JCS actually sent a letter to Congress in the middle of January noting that they intended to abide by the restrictions on appropriations and to treat them as law. So it's reading the tea leaves, it may be quite difficult for the administration to persuade the uniformed services to carry out such an order, which would itself be a suggestion that the order would not be given. So you add to that the politics of these things, which are going to get harder, I think, for the administration, not easier, as we move towards the November election. And I find it unlikely that the administration is going to seek to pick a fight, at least before the election, with respect to the closing of Guantanamo, and also doubtful that there's a sufficient time after the election to get it done. But I guess that's just my reactions, Karen, I have that makes me think that we may have Guantanamo for some time to come.
Okay, so we agree on the president not using his authority to unilaterally defy Congress. It just doesn't seem to me like that's where this is going to be headed. And I do think the numbers of those who are on the original list of 48 are lower than you think. I think it wasn't just the trade. There's been a number that were previously considered too dangerous to release that have come off that list. And my guess is that number is going to get reduced, you know, that trend is going to continue. But something else I wanted to bring up was that there's last week there was and this is a coming back to the military commissions again, which I do think in a way shines a light towards how to maybe bring this thing to closure, which is that, you know, last week the government suggested some reforms in the way the military commissions are being done. And among the things that they talked about was taking the death penalty off the table and opening the aperture for plea deals. And forgetting the 9/11 defendants right now and turning to some of these other cases, some of which have been charged or others of which may or may not go before a military commission, once there's some kind of legal process in place by which there can be some kind of plea arrangement, I'm not so sure that there aren't a number of individuals who are in that category of too dangerous to release who may plead guilty. And one of the things that we haven't really talked about here is the huge impediment at Guantanamo to what these individuals can and cannot be charged with. And as I'm sure most of these listeners know, and as you know, the material support, it was not a law of war crime when the military commissions were established and when these people were incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay. And as a result, you know that they can't be charged in that way. And they can't be charged so far, and this is being litigated now, but we think with standalone conspiracy. Material support charges in federal court, that is how we have tried the 424 individuals who have been tried in court since 9/11 on terrorism charges. And we're just talking al-Qaeda and associated jihadist cases. We're not even including in this others like Hezbollah and Hamas crimes. So the idea of using some of the strengths of the federal court system, the statutes on which they rely, the sort of way in which they've determined a way forward for terrorism trials seems to me, once again, after a long time when it wasn't a possibility at all, a real possibility, not just for the 9/11 case, which really needs to happen, and not in 6 years, but now, but for some the 20 or so that are in this category of the 40 that are mentioned every now and then as individuals who could be charged. And in material support, there are different, you know, there are, this isn't something I necessarily support, but there are broader interpretations of the law. And if it is applied to Guantanamo detainees in the same way that it's been applied to people on U.S. soil, then I can foresee some kind of procedural progress here in federal courts, which allow for plea deals to be made, which I think is another way to hasten the closure of Guantanamo.
Just a few things with that. When it comes to the population of folks who we want to hold but we can't be tried, one of the real restrictions on that is simply that the material support statutes did not apply extraterritorially to non-U.S. persons until after 9/11. One of the provisions of the Patriot Act closed off that loophole. And so what we found, or, you know, what I understand the administration has found when they've been reviewing this population, is that there are people for whom you know, they were picked up in the early months of the war against Afghanistan, and we do not have, you arguably do not have jurisdiction to prosecute them because their action, their participation with the Taliban, and the like in Afghanistan, and their affiliation with those groups was at that time not subject to prosecution in the civilian court. So that actually has been a big, big problem. In this population, we have thoughts, evidence, intelligence about who they are and kind of where they stand currently and where they did then, but we actually don't have a civilian crime to charge him with. And, you know, as you know, given the, where the D.C. Circuit has gone on the material or support statute, that has been taken out of currently, in any event, the arsenal of U.S. prosecutors. So I think that has posed a real problem. Then the second thing is that a lot of these individuals were picked up you know, at a time and in a manner by military services, by foreign allies and the like, in ways in which they were being picked up on a battlefield, you know, literally or otherwise. And therefore, the evidence that we would have to charge them is not the kind of evidence, you know, we have intelligence, we have hearsay, you know, we have that we may find reliable, but would not be admissible in a federal federal criminal court, which, you know, has always been one of the issues driving you know, the military commissions themselves, when you know President Bush put them together, and President Obama amended and you know kept them in some form or fashion. So I think those are you know that's what's driving the fact that there's a population of people that we want to detain, but you know we have so far in any event, and I think maybe indefinitely we'll be unable to prosecute them. You know, on that front,
we're unable to prosecute them in any system. It's hard to see the military commissions as anything but a failure. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, I think that it is difficult to argue with where things are, and I think people could point fingers in, you know, in a variety of ways. But from a standpoint of simply just efficacy, you know, you are in a situation in which not very many people have been successfully prosecuted in the military commissions, and I mean, I think that gives greater salience, you know, to some extent to this law of war detention. You know, it's not so easy to say that the problem can be solved simply by prosecution determining sentences and then, you know, releasing anybody we can't prosecute. There's a very significant number of people that we can't prosecute. There's obviously been, you know, a number of bumps up and down in the military commission system. And it is interesting to me that the Obama administration remained committed to the process in principle, and in fact, you know, passed an amended statute, and yet has seemed extremely diffident when it comes to who they recommend for prosecution and, you know, and moving the system forward. But again, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves in terms of the military commission system has not been the solution to a large number of, you know, Guantanamo detainees, you know, from the standpoint of how to handle them, you know, in the long term.
So let me ask you a follow-up question, which is that you say, as is often said categorically, these cases just can't be tried in federal court. The evidence isn't there. This would be hearsay. It would never be allowed. But, you know, federal courts are amazingly flexible in terms, at least from my point of view, in terms of how to find ways forward, whether it's dealing with classified evidence, whether it's dealing with witnesses that are hard to get at. There's a lot of ways in which terrorism cases and national security cases have really had to, you know, thread the needle in very unusual ways. And so really what I want to ask you is, I know we're saying this, but we haven't tried. Yep. We've tried one detainee. It was a case that made a lot of people unhappy, but the detainee is serving a life sentence in the supermax. Don't you think it might be worth some trial balloons to give the federal courts a chance to see just how they might want to handle these cases?
So, you know, I think that the federal courts have been an important part of our prosecution efforts in the war on terror, you know, historically. I mean, over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, I would, you know, in most of those cases, you have situations in which the individuals are picked up domestically through ordinary law enforcement, you know, the FBI and otherwise. I mean, many of the material support cases that you're citing, you know, those are the facts, and those are traditional law enforcement cases, and they've certainly been effective. There have been some which have involved individuals picked up abroad, and obviously the Obama administration has sought to do that prospectively. I mean, we do not have, to the extent we have a prospective detainee policy, you know, in this armed conflict, you know, the Obama administration has picked up folks, held them for short times, often on boats or a couple times on boats, and then transferred them to the United States for prosecution. So It can happen. What they have done, though, is they really have foregone the opportunity to hold people for intelligence purposes for a longer period of time. And I mean, I think you may, if you saw, Karen, there was an article in the New York Times, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, suggesting that we lack any kind of clear policy when it comes to detainees we may pick up when we're fighting with ISIS, which is, you know, remarkable way in which our hands are, you know, it's been tied behind our back. In terms of whether there are avenues that we can explore that we haven't done in, you know, in terms of in federal court, I think a lot of that depends upon the case. I mean, obviously, as you know, they transferred Galiani from Gitmo to the Southern District of New York, and that was someone who, you know, had previously been the FBI had been involved in investigating the case, and they brought him on, and it was close. I think, I mean, he was convicted of a crime and received a lengthy sentence. On the other hand, he was acquitted of 143 of the 144 charges. You know, so which is not something that gives gives full confidence, you know, that we're going to see, we would see acceptable outcomes. It just becomes very difficult in most of these cases, you know, where the FBI didn't start investigating the incident from the very beginning, you know, which they did in the embassy bombing, to collect evidence in the form that we normally tried in federal court. And we have, you know, noted incidences more before 9/11, in fairness, than after, in which there have been the disclosure of intelligence information. And the like, in ways that harm our, you know, that harm our national security. And I would just say, just to sort of, you know, to put a point on it, you know, we have a situation here where the Obama administration, which I think came into office with different presuppositions than, you know, many in the Bush administration, reached the same conclusion largely when it came to federal courts with respect to the population at Guantanamo. And, you know, we did not see a host of federal court prosecutions from the Obama administration, and they've been very reluctant to go forward. And in fact, again, they, you know, with some diffidence, they reendorsed the military commission process, which I think reflects the reality of these cases when it comes to the evidence and the offenses and the like.
Okay, just a couple of things. And I hear you. The idea that there's been evidence that's been released in court that harmed our national security, I actually don't think that's accurate. And I know that there's a couple of people that say it, but I've never heard anybody say what it was or that it was or that it's happened. I think federal judges are immensely sophisticated about the use of classified materials in their courtroom. And what's interesting about the use of SEPA is how much defense attorneys and prosecutors seem to agree that before 9/11 and after 9/11, it works. And so I mean, we can, you know, talk about that after this conversation, but I've always wanted to know what that information was. So that's the first thing. The second thing, you're right about how many of these cases have been people who we have apprehended domestically, but many haven't been. And in the last year alone, the Southern District and a court in Connecticut have tried a number of individuals that were tied to Al-Qaeda Central, who have been tried here in federal court, in which there are a number of issues that will come up at Guantanamo that have come up here. I mean, one issue that you and I haven't talked about, and it's worth bringing up, is that there's a suspicion within a lot of critics of the military commissions and Guantanamo in general that one of the reasons these cases are not being tried is they don't want to reveal not things about classified material or sources and methods, but what the United States actually did in terms of its detention and treatment of these individuals, which always surprised me because at this point in time, we know what occurred. And so why would that be an obstacle? But it does come up, and so I do need to mention it here. I want to come back to my point. Nothing you said made me think that the federal courts shouldn't be given a chance to do this. And the one thing you did say, which is the Gailani case, where he was acquitted on 283 of 284 charges, largely because he was not charged with the murders and of the deaths of the individuals in the embassy in Tanzania. Which is what many of those counts were. You know, one thing you have to say about the federal court system, and this sort of lies at the heart of all of this, is that when you go to trial, you might be acquitted. And that's what the Gailani case made everyone terrified of. However, in terrorism cases in this country, for better or for worse, there's really no chance of acquittal. And so I think you have to be able to take the risk of, as a robust system that trusts ourselves, that those who are guilty will be found guilty, just like Gailani was, and those who are not guilty will not be found guilty. So it always worries me, that argument, not because of Guantanamo, because of its larger philosophical underpinnings, which is that it's not okay to have a court system that would acquit people, and therefore we can't use this form of court procedure because it doesn't work, and that's why we have the military commission. That seems to me to be sort of a lose-lose situation. You can't have a military commission if the only purpose is to say somebody's guilty, even assuming that they're going to be proved guilty. You can't just say that has to be the answer. Otherwise, isn't it kind of a charade?
Yeah. No. Look, I think I don't think that the issue here with respect to Gitmo and the like is a question of we need trials because this is another way to deal with these folks. The question is that there's a significant number of people for whom we don't have the offenses or we don't have the evidence, but we nonetheless have intelligence, which gives us the right under well-established law of war principles to detain these guys for the duration of hostilities. So there's, we have one option, which maybe it's become almost a de facto option here, is simply, indefinite detention, without the, in other words, maybe having the framework of prosecution as a possibility has become more distraction than it's worth. I mean, as you note, however, the Bush administration decided and the Obama administration has continued that where there was evidence of specific war crimes, individuals would be, would be prosecuted. I think in many instances the federal courts are not. We're talking from the start at a small subgroup of people, or relatively small. I mean, because I think again on our current numbers, we're on the scheduled for prosecution. You're talking about maybe a dozen of the 80 who are there, and there's at least three times that number who the Obama administration has decided it will hold without prosecution. So one way or the other, obviously from the standpoint of our present conversation about Gitmo, I think it's not a solution, simply. But again, in any event, the numbers speak for themselves. So I guess maybe maybe we want to have time for questions if we want to open it up.
I have just one more question for you.
Go ahead.
Because you raised ISIS before.
Sure.
And I'm curious your answer to this. Given all that we know about the problems domestically and any other way that Guantanamo has created. One of the things that people say, this is the underlying current, let's keep Guantanamo open because we may have to put people there from ISIS, for which, as you point out, we don't have any specific detention plan that we know of, right? So the question is, would you want to keep Guantanamo open to prolong this policy for new detainees? There hasn't been anyone new put in Guantanamo 2008. Would you see that as a viable path forward?
It seems to me that if the United States is going to continue to be in an armed conflict against these various groups, and certainly that has been the history for 15 years, if not more, we need a place where we can detain people, for the long term in those conflicts. And our options are essentially to do it in theater, to do it at Guantanamo, or to do it in the United States. I'm personally less focused on the where than the weather. And I think to some extent the debate and the impasse here has frozen the policy process in place, and I think, to some real harm, in terms of, we're unable to have a framework. And I think part of what we've faced, at least what I saw at the end of the Bush administration, and which I think continued into the Obama administration, is there is a deal to be had in all of this. There is the notion of a institutional framework for long-term law of war detention. But what starts to happen, and more so on the Democratic side of the aisle, is that you start pulling at these frameworks, and folks do not want to institutionalize. I think to some extent there's probably folks within the Obama administration as well do not want to institutionalize a program of law, of law of war detention. It better, they would think, to have a common law in which the Guantanamo problem is largely whittled away and it kind of solves itself, you know, rather than you know, a situation in which we deal with things such as whether it's ISIS, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's, you know, Yemen or, you know, any other host of places. The notion that our only option apart from drones is to pick people up for, you know, very brief times, hold them on a boat, and then turn them over to the federal courts is not a satisfactory solution when it comes to a sort of long-term detention. It's remarkable that we can, you know, fight these wars that we're fighting, you know, without having answers to these questions. And, you know, a sort of ad hoc interagency policy process for every particular detainee does not strike me as, you know, a long-term solution here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's persuasive.
This is Dean Reuter. Let me interject, and let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Again, we're speaking with Stephen Engel, a partner at Deckert, and Professor Karen Greenberg. Not only is she a professor at Fordham Law School, she's the author of the upcoming book, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. That's due out just next week. The title, again, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, due out May 24th, presumably available on Amazon and at bookstores near you. If you have a question today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. We don't have a question pending. Let me make a comment, and then I'll ask a question while we see if anybody else rings in. I do know, I think in connection with some earlier comments, that I remember Andy McCarthy, former assistant U.S. attorney of the Southern District of New York, who tried the blind shake during the discussion about whether to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Manhattan in New York City. He came out against that and cited his having had to turn over in discovery a list of unindicted co-conspirators, which included Osama bin Laden, which ended up in the hands of bin Laden, and he thought was put to bad use by Osama bin Laden. So that's one instance I'm aware of, at least where there are some facts on the table that some information developed at trial or for a trial was later found in the hands of terrorists. But setting that aside, let me ask a question of either of you. And you've touched on this a little bit, Stephen Engel. I wonder if how the presence or absence of Gitmo relates to capturing versus killing belligerents and the collection of human intelligence. You've both mentioned, and I guess there's agreement, that nobody has been taken to Gitmo. No detainee has been taken to Gitmo for years, which presumably means they're being taken somewhere else that we don't know about, or they're not being captured at all. Will that lead to a dearth of intelligence, human intelligence, and is that a concern?
Karen, do you want to take crack, or I'm happy to do so.
Okay, go ahead.
I think it's a real concern. It's for those of us outside of government, it's difficult to hear the, you know, prove the dog that doesn't bark. You know, I would be surprised to if anybody is is launching a kinetic attack, you know, or the like. You know, self-consciously doing so because they think, you know, taking someone as a detainee will be too problematic. But there are bureaucratic costs to all of this, which are likely to have impact on policy outcomes. I mean, there's, you know, it's been reported, you know, and I'm thinking in particular of Charlie Savage has an excellent book on the Obama administration's national security legal process as well, which, you know, really gets on you know, inside the Obama administration. It's certainly been reported that, you know, as individuals were picked up one after another, there were very high level and extensive interagency discussions about what to do with every individual there. And if you're putting in place a system where there's a lot of costs and difficulty when it comes to this, and when there is no policy for how are we going to handle people going forward, you know, that I think that does have an impact on deterring people from thinking creatively and seeking, you know, the collection of individuals for intelligence value. And of course, given all of the you know, the issues and the controversies in the Bush administration over how individuals are to be treated when they are picked up, that too, you know, has costs and concerns and the like. So I, you know, I think that there is a real concern that we have lost an intelligence capability because of our failure to articulate a coherent detainee policy. Exactly how often that happens, and you know, and what intelligence we've lost from it. It's, you know, it's difficult for someone on the outside to you know, to assess, but certainly common sense suggests that you know, we've been, you know, fighting with at least a few fingers tied behind our back.
Anything to add on this point, Professor? Okay, we've got two questions pending on the phone now. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is John Eidsmo with the Foundation for Moral Law in Montgomery, Alabama. I'm a retired Air Force judge advocate, and I'm a strong supporter of the war on terror and a conservative. But I have a question that has troubled me on this for some years, and I certainly understand the argument that we're talking about terrorists here, and that therefore the normal due process guarantees do not apply. But doesn't that assume the basic premise that they are terrorists? Doesn't it ignore the very, very small possibility that maybe they were involuntary hostages or embedded journalists or whatever other possible explanation there might be?
Well, yeah, I'm happy to take a crack at that. You know, I think to some extent, you know, we've been talking about a variety of different frameworks here, including the prosecution side of things. When we're talking about, but there is also, there's been extensive litigation in which individuals have challenged their detentions. And one of the issues that was teed up in, you know, several, I guess three really, Supreme Court decisions during the Bush administration concerned the right of someone, as you said, and here we're talking about aliens who are picked up outside of the United States. And those are, you know, those are the people who are at Guantanamo Bay. Everyone there is a foreign citizen and was picked up, you know, outside of our borders. Nobody was transferred from the U.S. to Gitmo, you know, or the like. And there was a question of whether the writ of habeas corpus, which is a sort of fundamental way in which U.S. persons, U.S. citizens, generally speaking, have historically been able to challenge their detention, the lawfulness of their detention, whether that would apply to the folks at Guantanamo Bay. And in a series of cases, ultimately the Supreme Court said that the answer is yes. So as to, you know, individuals who have argued that they were, you know, in the wrong place in the wrong time and they were picked up, the Supreme Court has made clear, you know, after you know, a series of litigation that they would have that right. And so there has been an active detainee, you know, litigation process that began in the Bush administration and, you know, to some extent has continued, you know, here. That's a separate question from the question of, you know, what courts are available. You know, as to military commissions have historically been used by the United States in time of war in a number of different, you know, conflicts up through World War II. And in the Civil War as well, and the Bush administration set them up. Congress authorized them in 2006, and the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress reauthorized them in 2009. So that's, you know, that's where we are on the prosecution side.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question, and our lines are wide open.
Hi, this is Ken Simon. I'm with Aiken Gump, an associate in our D.C. office. And I was clerking last year with Judge Henry Hudson down in Richmond, and we had an interesting case, and I'm not going to get into. There's always already a verdict, but there was an individual, the Department of Justice prosecuted an individual who was captured abroad in Coast Province, had been held for a period of time. They brought him here. He was prosecuted, and the jury found him guilty of material support and other related charges for an attack on, alleged attack that the jury agreed with on one of the bases in Coast Province. Or the base in Coast Province. I mean, that was a fairly, and SEPA issues were there, and my co-clerk handled those. But that was, I mean, it seemed to run pretty seamlessly. There were certainly issues that arose. But I wonder if you all have, if you have any sort of knowledge of that prosecution. But beyond that, have there been other instances in the country? Because that didn't get a ton of sort of national press, where the administration is clearly sort of bringing what they might believe are slam dunk cases of individuals like that. I think that was the first of its kind where somebody was captured abroad and brought here for prosecution. I could be wrong about the way I'm saying that, but who had been captured on the battlefield. But in any event, any comments on sort of whether the administration has been trying to bring these sort of exemplar cases to buttress their argument that look, federal courts can handle these kinds of cases?
Sure. I mean, the Obama administration has self-consciously pursued that path. I mean, nobody has been transferred to Guantanamo Bay in the Obama administration, and there have been. I mean, it may be fewer than six, but there have been a number of individuals, who have been picked up. They've, in at least two instances, they were actually held on boats and questioned on boats for a period of time because we had nowhere else, precisely to where we wanted to put them. And then they were transferred to the federal courts for prospection. You know, I think prospectively, I think it's hard to scale this issue. I think the number of people that we seek to capture, or that we might have intelligence value to capture in these various armed conflicts that we've going on, far exceeds the number of people for which we're, would readily be prosecuting them for a civilian material support. But there certainly are instances where this is, has taken place. As to Guantanamo, that is more of a legacy problem because, as I noted before, a number of those people who we still want to detain were picked up prior to the 2001 amendments to the material support statute. So those individuals are likely not covered by federal law there. And then in addition, you need to some extent. It depends on the individual, but battlefield situations don't always make for easy collection of evidence, and so particularly for people who were picked up in the early stages in Afghanistan, it's not obvious that we have admissible evidence in that way.
Professor Greenberg, anything to add here? I fear we might have lost Professor Greenberg. We do have one final question pending. Let's see if we can squeeze this in. We've got about a minute left, so I'll ask the caller to be as brief as possible.
Yes, Frank Shepard speaking down in Miami. I'm wondering what the evidence is and whether the speaker, both speakers, if they're still on, what they believe that Guantanamo has really hurt us somewhere, out in the world or in diplomacy. What is the evidence of that? And also, since I'm asking, my understanding is that one or two of these folks are not willing to leave. They're pretty happy down there. Quite apart from where they might go, but can you all respond to the question and the implied response?
Sure. Yeah, sure. And I'm happy to, unless if Karen is back on, maybe she would be the right person for this. But if I'm the only one not muted, I'm happy to address it. The question of the harm to national security from Guantanamo Bay has been repeated for quite some time now. It probably at least a dozen years or so, and the difficulty is that it is so mixed in with a whole host of other reasons why people abroad may criticize the United States for one reason or the other, that it becomes hard to separate that. I mean, I think it's fair to say, given that national security officials of both parties have said it, that the situation of Guantanamo Bay, particularly in the Bush administration, was an issue that made that rose to the level of conversations, with our allies, where people criticized our policies. Now, some of that was related to how people thought we treated people there, either rightly or wrongly, with respect to interrogation or detention. Some of it presumably related to long-term law of war detention, which both President Bush and President Obama have endorsed, and as have the courts and Congress. In other words, I think as Karen referred to it, question of, that you don't solve the Guantanamo problem just by moving Guantanamo into the United States. And so, and then some of it maybe is about the notion of a sort of special offshore detention facility. So I think it comes up, or it has come up historically. I'd be surprised if it continues to come up with the same degree of frequency, particularly since a number of the other issues have been resolved in terms of treatment, access to courts, through the writ of habeas corpus and the like. And then how strong or how important this is in terms of, affecting bilateral relations. I'm not the diplomatic expert here, but certainly it's the kind of thing that people hear. But we hear less of it, and I think again, to some degree, I hear the administration talking more about the cost of Guantanamo than about its impact domestically or internationally. Just because I think it's hard to say that it still is such a critical issue. I think it's not obvious that so long as if we were to close it and still hold these folks in the United States that issue would really go away, as well.
Stephen, this is Dean Reuter. I think we have found Professor Greenberg and unmuted her telephone.
Yeah. I don't know, you guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. Apologies okay. If there was something on our end that got you disconnected.
I won't take it personally. So, I just want to, but I've been listening. Don't worry, because I could hear you. And
well, why don't we give you the final word here? Take a minute to respond to any or all of what you've heard, and we'll let you have the final word.
Well, the final word is that I've really enjoyed this discussion because, in a way, even though we've gone over the points that we've been over year after year after year, there is a sense in this conversation that we're going to have to figure this out, that we can't go on forever in this sort of limbo. And I think that's a very important milestone. And I think it's something the government is getting its arms around. And there are maybe two issues. And one of them, I just want to address this as our last point maybe, which is there, you mentioned the economies of scale and the issues of scale. And I just want to say that trying people, we're not talking about trying every single person who would be detained on a battlefield. And this has to do more with understanding the authorities for war and detention in war and what it means to hold somebody, as we always did prior to this, and a couple other times in our history, but close to the battlefield itself, close to the battle, understanding what the end of hostilities might look like, and not thinking that we can control this world in a way that this non-policy seems to suggest. And the second thing is about intelligence. The issue of our intelligence agencies has changed dramatically since 9/11. Our intelligence agencies are more robust. They have become part of all different parts of our government, whether it's the military, the intelligence, Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, the Department of Treasury, and we could go on. The kind of intelligence lapses that we had on 9/11, which were severe, should not exist anymore in that way. And therefore, the idea that our intelligence depends on capturing a broad amount of people and sort of figuring out what information they have is something that may be out of time and place, given the robustness and the resources that we've contributed to our intelligence apparatus since 9/11. So I think that's a game changer in terms of thinking how to go forward and what the purposes of these detentions really are for.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. I want to thank you both, Stephen Engel and Professor Karen Greenberg, also author Karen Greenberg. I mentioned the title of her book once before, twice before, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. It's out next week, but available now for order on Amazon and probably available already in bookstores. Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Thank you both for your participation and for staying late here. We've used more than our budgeted time. I also want to thank our audience for your thoughts and your questions. A note that we've got a newly scheduled Teleform conference call tomorrow afternoon. We'll be talking about the Zubik Little Sisters of the Poor case decided earlier today. But until that next scheduled Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.